There is panel. So the topic is equity and inclusion in Indian schooling. And for us to fully understand what the equity or inclusion looks like, we need to understand actually what an equitable society or institution look like. And even more importantly, we need to understand how the inequity or the exclusion look like so that we can build a inclusive and equitable society and institutions within. And today we are talking about and learning from our Indian colleagues and the Indian economist and intellectual, and also somehow like a little bit of my idol, professional idol, Amartya Sen has talked about the kind of the failure of Indian education system in a sense that it doesn't provide equal access to each child and also question the quality. And he's Indian himself, so he has a better position to talk about Indian education system than myself. But he compared the system to China, which is also a big country with a lot of people, and how China has been able to build an education system that is quite fair for everybody. But always there are, of course, regional differences and so forth, the same way than, for example, in Finland. But to compare, for example, India and Finland is quite difficult because the size and the population is so different. But now today we are learning from our Indian colleagues and looking into the social inclusion and how available and inclusive is the education system for its diverse learners. And we have our panelist, and I will be moderating the panel. I'm Heidi Lane, senior lecturer in global and sustainable education in the Faculty of Education and Psychology here in the University of Jyväskylä. And I will now present our panelists, and then they will also present themselves. So we have first Ira Jossi, who is an assistant professor at Aachen-Prentin University. Her teaching is in the domain of early childhood education. She teaches courses in early childhood education, both in Master in Education and Diploma in Early Childhood Education programs. Ira also anchors the Diploma in Early Childhood Education program and works closely with the course faculty to support the program objectives. Then we have Nimrat Kanbur, who joined the Aachen-Prentin Foundation in 2011 and is currently a part of the School of Continuing Education and University Resource Center, Aachen-Prentin University in Bangalore. She has contributed to the development and validation of individual and institutional quality frameworks, which have been used in various academic and field engagements across the states. And then lastly but not leastly, we have Jitendra Sharma, who joined Aachen-Prentin Foundation in 2011 as a resource person for the program on education leadership and management in Uttarakhand state, which I always fail to pronounce this state, but hopefully you can correct it. State team and was part of the core group who contributed in developing framework as well as training modules for conducting head teachers' professional development courses. Besides that, there's a long list of activities that he's been involved, but I'll let our panelists to introduce themselves first. Please have a short introduction.
Okay, so I'll start. So namaste sabko, good morning, and hua menta. My name is Jitendra, as Hedi ji just shared, and I have been part of Aachen-Prentin Foundation since 2011. My current responsibility is mainly to work with the school principals of Aachen-Prentin schools. There are nine such schools, and our entire effort in Aachen-Prentin Foundation is basically like in the education field. We are working towards, you know, ensuring equity by working with public schools, and our own schools are also, you know, we call them demonstration schools. So whatever, you know, we recommend in national policies. We try to practice it, and we try to see whether, it can be practiced in the context of similar to public schools. So I come with that sort of experience, and my association has been more with the practice part of education. So in today's sharing, I think I'll be bringing some experiences from, the practice aspect. So thank you for, organizing this and giving us this opportunity.
So I'm Nimrat, and in addition to what Haley said, the school I belong to basically is responsible for the professional development of various functionaries across states. We work already in multiple states across the country. So the School of Continuing Education tries to reach states where our presence is not already there in the form of field institutes. I have also been supporting the work of policy since work related to policy. You may be aware that we have this new education policy come out in 2020, and we had the National Curriculum Framework for the foundational stage, that is 3 to 8 years, in 2022, and now the School Education Curriculum Framework last year. So it's been a very collaborative process of development. So I've been supporting some states in this work, as well as working with national bodies in various committees, working groups, to kind of be part of this process. And so very happy to be here, and I hope we'll be able to share some things about our country which are new to you.
Thanks, Nimrat. Good morning. My name is Ira, and as Hedy has already introduced myself, I'd just like to add that I kind of anchor this program, the postgraduate diploma in early childhood education at the Azim Premji University. It's basically a 40-credit diploma program for working professionals. It's in a blended mode, so online and as well as some face-to-face interactions. And the idea is to kind of how do we equip and improve the quality of the early childhood education in this country. So it's more like a professional development in that sense program for these working professionals who are teachers, administrators, members from NGOs, and so on. And before this, I was working with organizations to support the early childhood education in the country by partnering with government, by partnering with other organizations using technology and so on. Thank you so much, and looking forward to our interaction.
Thank you. And then we will next have a little introduction about the Indian education system.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think I should go there, right? So I can change the
Yeah.
slides, or would you?
Either, yeah, if you want to come here, I can help you to tell me when
Then I'll,
there's a change.
yeah,
Yeah,
sure.
it's a little bit difficult because here is
Yes, I
the.
understand.
Yeah, and
I
then.
understand. Thanks.
Yes,
Thanks.
but
So I'll
it's
just
up to
speak
you.
from here,
Yeah.
right?
Come and stand here or.
No, this
Yeah.
is fine. Thanks. So, Abhita, Hedy, the three of us, we had a little discussion, and we thought that given that we're talking about India, we should have a little introduction, try and keep it really small. So, a brief overview. So, we're a large country. We have some 28 states, 8 union territories, and education is on the concurrent list, which means it is the business of both the central government, and state governments. So that's one part of it. There are about 1.5 million schools. You can see the data here. 265 million students, mostly in government schools, just about more than half in government schools, the rest in private aided, government aided schools or others. 9.5 million teachers, of which about 50% are teaching in government schools. 22, just to give you an idea, a sense of the diversity, we have 22 official languages in the 8th schedule of the Indian Constitution. And a survey conducted by a non-government organization identified 780 languages that are spoken in the country. So that's the vastness. We could go on, Hedy.
Yes.
Thanks. And then a little bit about access, equity, quality, which are seen as three main pillars of our education system, something that we try and achieve. So our policy documents refer to these three. And access here is
very narrow compared to what Haiti referred to, of course. This is actually physical reach, how many children are able to reach schools. So if we look at a survey done by the national, by the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare, this is a national family health survey from 2019-21. And it tells us that in that the period of 2019-2020, only 18% of children in urban areas and 12% of children in rural areas, age 5, were able to access early childhood education. So this is pre-primary school. So this is what the data tells us. There are other sources of data, but I think this was something that actually goes down to households and collects all this information. We also have a very robust system for collecting data in our country, which is called the Unified District Information Systems for Education. And so this is all government data. Our GER is pretty good at the primary level. At the upper primary level also, it's okay. But it decreases as we move to the secondary and the higher secondary level. So I'll talk about the stages as well. But basically, when we talk about secondary, we're talking about 14 to 16-year-olds. And high secondary, we're talking about 16 to 18-year-olds. So the participation decreases as we proceed through the school stages. In the next.
Yeah.
A few equity indicators, gender parity index, we're doing pretty well. The ratio of boys and girls, it's good at all levels. Minority enrollment is 18% of the total enrollment. The last large-scale census that we had in the country regarding population found that that was only in 2011. We haven't had a census since then. That 19.3% of the population are minorities, so it's kind of proportionate. In terms of socioeconomically marginalized groups, that's also okay. It's proportionate to the population, the total population. Children with disabilities, only about less than 1% are actually enrolled in schools. And if you look at the occurrence in the population, it's about 2.2%. So we're not doing so good well there. If you could go on, Haiti.
Yes.
And out-of-school children, again, there are varying figures brought out by different organizations. But if you look at the government data from 2017-18, the National Sample Survey Office does these large-scale surveys in various fields. It's a sample survey, but it's a large-scale survey. So about 32 million children in the age group of 6 to 17 years were out of school. Contested figure, of course, but this is a representation. We could. The National Achievement Survey is an indicator of how children are learning. Again, this is a large-scale sampled test that's done across grades 3, 5, and 10. So if you look at how children are doing, we see that as we move from grade 3 to grade 10, the performance becomes poorer. It's not so great at the primary level also. And the last National Achievement Survey done, the last one was in 2021, and the one done before that was in 2017, before COVID. And across grades, the learning levels have fallen. So you can see some impact of COVID there. Haiti, if you could click, please. Thank you. We do have a right to free and compulsory education act in place. This is for 6 to 14-year-olds. So in our country, that would be grade 1 to grade 8. And there has been an amendment. This was through a constitutional amendment. A clause was inserted in the clause pertaining to right to life, giving children of this age group the right to free and compulsory education. And there was also a change in Article 45 of the Constitution, which said earlier that the state shall endeavor to provide ECC to all children. Now it is that the provision for ECC to children below the age of 6 years. So there is a increasing commitment to this age. We could go on, Haiti. Thank you. The structures are about to change. So we are the cusp of change in our country. Many, many changes are happening as we will have the last year and as we proceed through the next couple of years. And right now the structures are that early childhood care and education is for 3 to 6 years. Then we have elementary school, which is a right, primary and upper primary. So this is for 6 to 14 year olds, secondary school, elementary school for us would be grades 1 to 8. Again, grade 1, children would be 8, 6 years. Then 14 to 16 year olds, grades 9 and 10. And then higher secondary school, which would be 16 to 18 year olds, grades 11 and 12. The new structure is going to be, I'll just mention it now, but I'm sure as we go on, we'll talk more about the whys and whats of the new structure. So basically now there's a foundational stage which integrates the early childhood care and education stage with grades 1 and 2. So the provision is for ages 3 to 8, and this is related to the curriculum and pedagogy of early childhood education. Next, there's the preparatory stage for 8 to 11 years, grades 3 to 5. A middle stage for grades 6 to 8. So this pretty much remains the same. What has changed in the secondary and the higher secondary is that they have been now seen as a single stage instead of two separate stages. So this is the structure that we will be moving towards. And if you could just... And this is the last. We thought it would be useful to just talk about the structures in place. And I think as it was the case in your country earlier, we have a separate kind of a structure for the early childhood care and education part of it, and separate for school education. So we have the Ministry of Women and Child Development, which looks after the ECC part. There's a central institute, the National Institute of Public Cooperation and Child Development, which looks after the curriculum, the training, all of preparation of teachers, etc. At the level of states, there's a Department of Women and Child Development, and then there are these structures in place to support the teachers in the ECC centers, which are called Anganwadis, which literally means courtyard. So every habitation would have a Anganwadi, and you would have a worker there, or who are also known as Anganwadi teachers in some states. So this would be a 10th or a 12th grade pass out who has received some training in the pedagogy, curriculum pedagogy assessment of early childhood care and education, and might be helped with by an Anganwadi helper. As far as school education goes, so not at the same level in terms of district or state, but we have the Ministry of Education, then a central body called the NCERT, the National Council of Educational Research and Training, which is the academic authority for curriculum assessment, also develops materials at the central level, which states may or may not decide to take up. At the state level, we have a similar body called the State Council for Educational Research and Training, which would be typically responsible for developing the state curriculum framework. Given the diversity, there is this need for states to develop their own curricula and materials also, and various other functions, all related to supporting schools and the implementation of curriculum. At the district level, we have the district institutes for education and training, which are positioned as academic leaders of the district. So the idea is to decentralize and cater to diversity within the administrative structures as far as possible. So the district institutes would be doing something like teacher training, developing materials maybe at the district level. So for example, a district level institute might create a dictionary of local words in languages which are prevalent there, but not the medium of instruction. And then we have the block level resource centers, which typically would be responsible for 75 to 100 schools. So in most states at the block resource center, you would have a special educator, you would have equipment, you have materials. So it is a center for teachers to come to for any kind of support that they need. A block resource center might also help in schools in terms of planning, implementation, etc. And closer to the school still is a cluster resource center, which a coordinator in the center would be responsible for maybe 8 to 10 schools and would be involved in providing on-site support. So I hope this kind of sets the context and doesn't kind of complexify the whole thing. So that's it from us about the context.
Thank you. And our online participants, if you have any questions or comments, you can open your microphone or you can use the chat to comment, and also audience here in Ruusupuisto. Please feel free to think about questions to our panelists. And I would like to mention that I really appreciate that actually this topic of today's panel, the equity and inclusion, came from our panelists. And it's also something that I think Finland as a society and as you know our education system can learn from, and really important topic to discuss about. And I was earlier mentioning about Amartya Sen, mentioning about the challenges of Indian system providing kind of equal access to education for all the children. When we talk about inclusion, we can kind of think it from a special education perspective, or we can talk about it more from a social inclusion perspective, that how do we actually provide access and quality access to education for all the children. We would like to now learn from you in your education context. At least for me, what I have really learned from Indian system is also that despite the challenges, there are also foundations like Achim Prent Foundation that is really doing a lot of very remarkable work in the remote areas and trying to provide more equitable and inclusive education system. So for our panelists, what does the inclusion and equity mean to you in your context?
So if I start from the policy perspective, and I refer back to the National Education Policy 2020 that I mentioned, I think what you said, Heidi, about inclusion not being limited to just disabilities is something that people have to kind of get used to. When we work with teachers, when we work with functionaries, when you talk of inclusion, immediately it's children with disabilities. Of course, for us, the definition has been, of course, more comprehensive. And if we look at the policy, it refers to, I will kind of try and state what it actually defines in terms of, you know, the groups that need equitable access, quality learning, and need to be included in all processes. So a term called the socio-economically disadvantaged groups is used in the policy. And this term is operationalized in terms of gender, which is women, especially women, girls, and transgender identities. Then geographical identities. So this is something that the policy emphasizes, talks about the fact that there are certain geographies where students might not be able to access the kind of education that would enable them to, you know, continue further. For example, the primary schools that we referred to, that I referred to during the presentation, you would have one in within 1 kilometer of which students stay, and an upper primary school would be within 3 kilometers. So that is walking distance. But the moment they move to secondary school, they might have to commute to a city. There might be problems with language. There might be problems with, you know, being from a different place. There might be just problems about being able to stay and learn. So geographical identity is something that the policy brings up, and also refers to the need for a kind of a special provision for specific geographies. So that's one part of it. Then there is groups that are in vulnerable positions in terms of socioeconomic conditions. So these would be, the definition goes beyond groups that have been marginalized historically to the urban poor, children of migrant families, students who come from backgrounds which are disadvantage in terms of the kind of facilities they have at home, etc. The policy refers to victims of child trafficking or the children of people who've been trafficked. So that's I think I've got the points here because I didn't want to miss out on anything. And of course, children with disabilities. And the policy specifically refers to learning disabilities. And I'd like to mention here that in 2016, we had an act called the Right of People with Disabilities, which kind of broadened the definition of disabilities to include learning disabilities. So there's a lot of focus on that in our country. The policy believes, if at a very basic level, that of course all children should be in school, students from these communities, and all of them should receive education of a comparable quality. And those who need any kind of specific support should be able to get that kind of support. So that's how the policy is looking at inclusion and equity.
So if I may just extend Nimrit's point, and I'd kind of focus on the early childhood education space. The National Education Policy 2020 talks about universal provision of quality ECC so that all children entering grade one are school ready. So now if we were to look at this statement from the policy, one can look at three important aspects that are being covered here. So one is that ECC is available and accessible. So the required structure systems are in place so that children can attend ECC. The distance, it's not very far from where children are. Affordability, it's available either free of cost or it is affordable by children. And it meets the needs of the family and, the families in that area. So that's the access and availability. But the other part, an important one, is participation. So if children are in ECC centers and spaces, are they all getting equal opportunities to participate in the learning experiences in that center? Which is very important, because just attending an ECC center is not enough. Children should be able to have the agency, should have the choices, and should be able to meaningfully participate in the experiences. The third thing that, again, Nimrit talked about is the support. So is the necessary support and enabling environment provided to all children, irrespective of where they come from, which languages they speak, what is their sex, which families they come from, and so on and so forth. So that's the third important part. And situating it in the context that children who are coming from these socially disadvantaged backgrounds or marginalized families are already at a disadvantage than children who may have these resources or these choices at home. So in that case, how do we kind of build the required skills, the competencies for children so that they are able to cope in the ECE centers and they are prepared for grade one, and so on. And just one quick example here, because I think it's very important that when we are thinking of the support, we're not just thinking about education, because the disadvantage could also mean that children do not have the health, the well-being, or they may not have access to good nutrition. And I think that's important to see the intersection of education with health, nutrition, and these other aspects, which are very important to help all children or enable and provide the opportunities for all children to be prepared for lifelong learning, to be prepared for formal education in grade one. So just wanted to bring in this aspect of looking at the intersections of all these other important services that children would need and are important for children to transition to formal school. Anjit may be wanting to add about the formal school.
Yeah, so should I just continue on that same question? Okay, so before I think we go more in what exactly is happening on this front in terms of practice, I think the way I see it is that, you have policies which are, one way is to look at equity and inclusion, to basically look at the policy, whether that addresses the issue fairly well. Then we have programs that basically help policies, implementation. And the last part is what you see happening every day in schools and classes. These are the three broad areas for understanding what is happening on the equity and inclusion front. My knowledge is that on policy and program front, I think we have done very well over the years, and through our national education policies and curricular frameworks, we are doing fairly well. It is the last bit, you know, the and the most important part where, you know, the policy, whatever you guarantee, you know, a student or a child, you know, that experience is, you know, that happens at the classroom level or a school level. That is where I think we have made significant progress if we compare it with maybe previous decades. But that is where I think we need to do most of our, you know, attention and intervention and, you know, improvement, all that. So another way of looking at it, I think, and there are good frameworks to understand equity. The one that I found very, you know, useful is the 4A framework. I think if those who have read about right to education, they may already know what is this 4A framework. It's by somebody who worked at UNESCO. Her name is Katrina Tomasevsky. And see, this 4A framework basically means that, you know, whether education is available, that is the first A. Availability to ensure availability. I was shifting to Hindi. The second A is basically accessible. The school may be next door, but it may not be accessible to you because you don't have this, you know, your, you know, identity card. Maybe you don't have enough money to pay, or you don't have, you know, the family doesn't want to send you to that school. So accessibility is the next, you know, thing that one needs to ensure. Then it is about acceptability. You know, whether the, you know, the public, you know, whether the families, you know, whether children, you know, do they find education that the state is providing acceptable? You know, they may have issues with the language of instruction. You know, if it is not English, they may not want to come there. They may have issues with the treatment they're getting in schools. You know, so, you know, you go there one day, ideally you should be happy to go back to school next day. But, you know, it may happen that, you know, next day you don't want to go because the kind of experience you had the previous day. So that is basically about acceptability. And finally, the final A is about adaptability. So who has to adapt? Whether children have to adapt based on schools' practices and norms and, you know, systems and whatever they have to offer, or whether a school need to adapt themselves to the individual needs of students. That's where, you know, and it's very clear who has to do the adaptation bit. You know, it's the schools and teachers who are supposed to do it. So if you look at all, you know, this whole framework, it basically, you know, gives a very clear, you know, understanding of equity and inclusion. And it also tells us or informs us how to basically go about it. So in India, we can say that we have done a lot on the first two A's, which is making education available and accessible, because you can do it through policy and programs. So that's where we have done well. When it comes to acceptability by the public and the adaptability, you know, factor from the school side, that is where we have to do more work. You know, we have schools everywhere, but you may find that if, you know, people may not trust the quality of maybe public schools, so they may not want to go there. So we have to do something to raise the quality of these public schools. And that's why Azim Premji Foundation has taken up this whole issue of, you know, improving quality of public schooling in India. Because if you want to do something in equity in India, and education is the, you know, major vehicle for doing it, then we have no other choice but to raise the quality of public schooling in India. That's where most of the disadvantaged and underprivileged, you know, children go. So these two are, you know, the major areas I feel where we can talk more, like with some specific examples, but you know, and the data, you know, on enrollment, on how many schools are there in public and private. And in India, see, the issue, major issue is that because of the scale and diversity, it is really difficult. And also, you know, because of this status that education equal responsibility of states and central government. So, you know, you may have some very good program or policy at central level, but the state government also, you know, they need to take that initiative and that they are going to implement it or, you know, take that forward in their own state. But if they have other thoughts, they may not, you know, comply with it, or they may not, you know, align with those ideas. And that's there because of, you know, the kind of governance or we have. So the point I was trying to make is that, see, at one point we were talking about, you know, common schooling in India. And in a country like Finland, I think you have it. And in many other like countries, the public schools are so, you know, functioning so well that, you know, whether you are rich or poor, you know, you get to access, you know, high quality education, and that can become, you know, your, you know, pathway for, you know, whatever you want to achieve in life. In India, you know, we have a multi-layered, you know, system. And it, you know, even though, you know, we work in education and for very long, it is very difficult to you know, find a way to have common schooling. We may finally arrive there, but currently, you know, the fact is that we have this multi-layered schooling, and therefore we talk about education of comparable quality. See the difference, you know, common schooling against education of comparable quality, because that's what I think we're trying to achieve in the short term. In the longer term, maybe common schooling, but at the moment it is basically how can we provide education of comparable quality. So therefore, if you read policy documents, you'll find, you know, something which appears little contradictory on surface. On one hand, you may read something which is basically advocating common schooling, but at the same time, you may read another recommendation that talks about, you know, having special schools where you will basically select promising students, and they will get free and very good quality education. So on one hand, you know, so it seems that, okay, are you contradicting yourself? But it may be a, you know, a measure taken for in the interim period, like it's not forever, but okay, what can we do for the immediate future? So let's provide, you know, some quality education to maybe a smaller group from those sections who don't have good quality education. And maybe these people will be like role models for the others, and they can get inspiration from this group. So that's the complexity of, you know, ensuring equity and inclusion in India. So that's just one example from the policy front. So I'll stop here.
Thank you. And I think it was interesting when you were kind of comparing India and Finland. I was just thinking from the slides that Nimrat mentioned that you have 9.8 million teachers and we have a little bit less than 6 million people in Finland. So kind of in comparison, I think, I mean, also what was mentioned, availability, accessibility in Finland also, we can say that, you know, that's something that is in place. But then nowadays more and more the acceptability and adaptability is maybe something that we need to kind of work on. So in kind of different context, similar challenges in terms of, for example, with the diversification of the society, not all the families are, for example, accepting the schools in their neighborhood anymore because they think that there's, for example, too many immigrant families in the schools. And so there are these challenges that we are facing that we need to. And I really liked also the kind of the socioeconomic excluded groups being mentioned in the policies, maybe something that is for us to learn from. And Nimrat, you mentioned also that you are going through a lot of reforms at the moment. What do you see? What are the opportunities with these reforms to kind of create a more equity and inclusion in a system? And what challenges you think that will remain? I think some of these were already mentioned, but anything that you want to, yeah, any of you want to add?
So I'll just very broadly, I think the first step towards equity and inclusion, and the policy specifically mentions this, says that without universalizing early childhood care and education, the rest of the policy is just words, literally. It's not going to work. Mm. So this formalizing of the new structure of school education, where the foundational stage, 3 to 8 years, children will slowly, of course, it'll take time because, like you saw, we have different structures. And I think we have a lot to learn from your experience with this transition. And we are already seeing, signs of it not, obviously not being easy, but it might be harder than even we anticipate, because it's difficult to break these structures. So, but the point is that going ahead, if we make ECC a part of school education, and some states already have pre-primary classes, so two minus grade one. And I think Ira will be able to talk more about this, so I'll leave it for her. So one reform is that, where you bring children into the school system early. The second, of course, is something that's always ongoing. The whole, what Jeet also mentioned about the kind of schooling experience that students have. So this whole curriculum and pedagogy, what should it be like? The policy actually mentions school culture, etc. And the NCF takes pains to illustrate how this kind of a school culture and school processes can be created, which will be inclusive and equitable. So that's one part of it, I think. The other is we are expanding the curricular areas, not, you know, in the sense that we are bringing back things that we lost. So with the whole focus on science, mathematics, languages, and the social sciences, we've lost out on the arts, physical education, well-being, certain interdisciplinary areas, vocational education, working with your hands. So I think bringing in all these areas will offer students, all students, an opportunity to do something that they enjoy and maybe want to come back to school for. So that's another reform I see that could be significant. Another thing that the National Curriculum Framework does, of course, in 2017, the National Council of Educational Research and Training came out with the learning outcomes for the country, which states adopted or adapted as they wished. But this whole movement towards competency-based teaching and learning, it has been concretized in the NCF in terms of learning standards. So we have curricular goals and we have aims for each subject. We have curricular goals and competencies that are to be achieved at the end of each stage. And although the foundational stage curriculum details out illustrative learning outcomes, and these are not detailed out for other grades, I think the emphasis being on the foundational stage more so because it's been very critical. So that is an attempt to ensure that all students are able to achieve learning of a comparable quality. Another thing about these learning standards is that the focus is more on doing and learning the methods and processes rather than just the content. So I see these as some major shifts. And lastly, teacher education. There's a huge shift on making teacher education better in our country. It's a whole different story about teacher education in our country, so I won't go into that. But the policy has a lot of emphasis on improving teacher education. So, Ira, if you could expand on that.
Yeah. Okay. Clearly there is a clear commitment in the policy with respect to inclusion, diversity, equity. And that's kind of, a running theme all the way from ECE to higher education. I think one thing that would be interesting to think of is when we look at, especially when we look at the early childhood education space in our country, the ECC is, the three core service providers for ECC in our country are the government, which is the public sector. We have the private sector, and we have the non-for-profit sector. So what happens is the government or the public sector, they have been running the largest comprehensive ECCD program in this country since 1975, which is the Integrated Child Development Services Scheme, which really addresses health, nutrition, education, all the different aspects, and follows a life cycle approach. So, you know, looking at adolescent girls, looking at pregnant and lactating women, children, you know, in the 0 to 3 age group, as well as the education component for 3 to 6 year olds. So really follows that approach. It is kind of directly takes on from, you know, the goal is to support children's learning and development in the early years and, you know, think of a holistic development. This is available. I mean, we have like 14 lakh Anganwadi centers. I think that would be 1.4 million ECC centers run by the government in the country. So that's the extent and scale of this program and really looking at aspects related to equity and inclusion. The other sector, which is very fast growing now, is the private sector. And the private sector is mostly driven by the objective of profit. It really kind of, you know, addresses a very special need in the education system. One is to get children to get admission into grade one. So really looking at school readiness in a very narrow, limited form of only academics. So reading, writing, that kind of thing. And the other thing is, of course, it's, you know, fee paying. These schools are fee paying. They range from very high end, high-paying schools, preschools, to affordable private preschools, again, a market that's growing in the country. So people who have money can go to the high-end ones, send children to the high-end preschools. Parents who seek English language, which is, again, an aspirational thing, would send their children to these affordable private preschools with the underlying objective that perhaps because they're teaching in English, they're of better quality, which necessarily may not be the case. So that's the private sector emerging in rural areas as well as in urban areas in the country. So in terms of challenges and you know issues related to equity, I think it's very clear that affordability and having the resources means that you are going to a private space. The public sector, unlike in Finland, is generally you know considered more for children from disadvantaged backgrounds because of the kind of services it also provides beyond education. Also, there are questions related to quality of the preschool component or the education component in these government-run childcare centers. So that's the second thing. The third point I want to bring about in terms of things to think about, while the policy, it presents a very enabling framework when it comes to use of a mother tongue or local language. So the policy proposes that in early years, children should be exposed to their home language, the mother tongue. That should be the medium of instruction in these EC spaces. And all languages of children are welcome in the EC space so that children don't feel alienated. You know, it's a big transition for a child from their home to the EC space. But again, going back to the other point that I was making about these private spaces, because a lot of English is the aspirational language, many times what happens is the medium of instruction is English. Children, you know, children's home languages may not necessarily be welcome. And when we say home languages, we're not talking about all children having one local home languages. We are talking about many, many languages in the classroom. So what happens is that children who may be from a different, you know, culture or speaking different languages may again feel alienated in that environment in the preschool. So again, that's something that we really need to, while the policy acknowledges it, how is it that in our practice, the teachers can, you know, create a curriculum which, you know, which kind of looks at the local context, which brings in the local context, the languages, the cultures of children into the classroom so that all children feel welcomed. You know, what Jeet was talking about, how can schools or, you know, EC centers acknowledge that and bring all those aspects? How can families be involved, right? Can there be a good, you know, family involvement and participation in the EC centers? So how can we kind of do that more effectively? I think these would be some interesting things to think about and work on, which again goes back to the last point that Nimrit made about the teacher training and teacher professional development, how can our teacher training programs really explicitly have modules on inclusion, diversity, because the teachers themselves have to believe in it to be able to do it or, you know, adopt it in their classrooms. Thanks. Jyoti, you want to please add?
So continuing with this like reforms thing, so I'll talk about, I think, two, three major and recent developments in Indian education, and they are going to, I think, make, I think, significant or like ground, like path breaking changes in ensuring equity and inclusion. Teacher education. So the kind of, if you look at Indian policy document today, it basically, you know, it says, okay, we are going to lift the status of this teacher education profession, and those who want to enter in this profession, you know, they, you know, will be selected properly, and they will have to go through like a 4-year proper course for it, for as a pre-service, because in India, if you want to really work with teachers and improve their, you know, professional competence, you have to basically do it in in-service mode. So while they're teaching, and you hardly get like 1 or 2 weeks for that, you know, and that is very little time to basically improve anyone's competence. And when it comes to teachers' competence, you know, you definitely need a very high quality pre-service education, as you have it in Finland, so you don't worry much about the in-service bit. So we have taken steps in that direction, though if you go deeper into it, you'll find there are, you know, ways of, you know, getting a teacher degree after your undergrad degree in 2 years. You know? So there are some concerns in that front, but at least you have, you know, you are basically saying to universities, okay, you know, you have to run a proper 4-year course in like next 5 years or 10 years. So that is going, if that gets implemented properly, we will have a much better pre-service teacher education in India in like in the next 10 years. But what to do till that happens? So I think for that, since we have like 9 million teachers teaching in schools, so we have to make sure that, you know, we find ways of making in-service teacher development, professional development effective. And that's where I think an organization like ours is doing quite you know, good work. Like we are there in different blocks, right there, you know, going to every single school, trying to see them at work so that we know exactly what they are teaching and how they are teaching. And then we can basically involve them, even if for a couple of hours every week, for, you know, discussion on how to do it better. So there is a lot of focus on, you know, practices in this whole in-service mode of teaching. So instead of going into like further detail on that, I'm saying that there is something significant happening, not only at policy front, but also in practice. And there is a role of an organization like ours who are doing, you know, good work in in-service teacher professional development. One significant thing you will notice if you read the latest document, which is the National Curricular Framework, and also the policy that we recently came up with at the national level, you will find that the entire document is written keeping in mind the practitioners, teachers. So a lot of dilution happens, you know, from policy to actual practitioners. And so we have paid attention to this fact that you should write the document in a form that teachers can directly access it. So you better avoid all the, you know, jargons that, you know, that may not be comprehensible to them. So the document has become huge, and it has even illustrations of even lesson planning. Why? Because that is our need. They need to know, okay, what is a good lesson plan? So we have included it in such a high-level document. You know, you may not probably do it here, but our context demands that, and that's why we have done those changes. So that is, I think, one significant thing. Another very important development that will go a very long way in ensuring equity and inclusion is this idea of school complex in India. If you, there is a dedicated chapter on that in our policy. See, we are in a position, we may have a large percentage of schools where the enrollment is like 20 or 30 children. So in such a school, it is very difficult to provide all the resources, human and other resources, because there are only 20, 30 children in that school. And you never know if, you know, some of them will also be migrating to cities. So you will have to actually close it down. So how do you make sure that, you know, a school is available within the walking distance and at the same time resourceful? You know, if you have added that every school will have an art and teacher or physical education teacher, how can you provide an art teacher to, you know, such a small school? So we have come up with this idea of a school complex. And in that school complex, the idea is that within a range of 5 kilometers radius, there are maybe 20 schools. Some of them are large schools, like K-12 schools. Some of them are very small schools. But all of them will be part of one school complex. And some decision-making autonomy will be given to the head of the school complex so that, you know, decisions are not taken at district or higher level. Decisions can be taken by the head of the school complex. And the, you will make provision for maybe a well-resourced audio-visual room at the school complex level. And every week you can basically have all these kids, you know, traveling or walking to the nearest bigger school. So, you know, they're part of the larger complex. And if, you know, a teacher is on leave, or, you know, you can basically send another teacher because there is a group of teachers associated with that school complex. The provision, or at least the policy recommendation, is that teachers should also be hired at school complex level so that it is easier. You know, they are local and they can, the school complex head can basically take a call where to, you know, place them as per the need of the school complex. You can have a physical education teacher who is going and, you know, working at least one day in one school. So that whole idea, I won't go into further detail of that, but the, you know, this is the structural change the policy is trying to bring, and that will actually ensure that you don't have to close small schools, and at the same time you will make sure that resources, both human and other, you know, teaching learning resources, are available to these schools. A third major change is what already Ira Ji has already spoken, that the attention being given to this, you know, the early years, 0 to 3 and then 3 to 8, that will go a long way in ensuring that students have good health, because they get fed well through that midday meal and other nutrition program. And by the time they reach eighth year, or the completion of foundational stage, we are hoping that we will ensure foundational literacy. So if we are able to ensure foundational literacy, many of them will progress in the education system. And if you don't do that, then there is no hope. You know, that is the basic minimum thing you have to ensure if you want them to progress further in the education ladder or the classes. And our own data, because we work in 7 states, we work in, you know, about 60 different districts. So our own data says that, you know, there is a major crisis on foundational literacy front. It was always there, but due to COVID, you know, it has, you know, gotten worse. And though there are efforts from government and non-government sides, we are still facing a crisis in learning, or like there is a lot of recovery that we need to do. And so if you can ensure foundational literacy at the right time, you can really help these kids to progress further, get what is, you know, guaranteed by the education system, and then maybe find better ways of, you know, livelihood, or improve their overall well-being. So
Heidi, if I may just add one point, which I kind of, I think, missed saying, was in terms of these policy reforms. Another thing that in the earlier slide, Nimrit had shown that there are quite a few children who still don't have access to ECCE. So what happens to those children? And I think there's another provision that the new policy talks about. It's kind of a three-month preparatory module for children who may not have had access to ECCE. So when they come directly to grade one, so that these children are not left behind, there's a three-month kind of module that's, being given, which is more play-based, activity-based, so that children who've not had the opportunities are still able to kind of cope. And this continuum of 3 to 8, which again is a curriculum and pedagogy continuum, again ensures that children still have are following a play-based, activity-based approach, which really takes into account their culture, their context. The curriculum is as per that, so that children have a smooth transition and are able to cope in the formal school environment. So these were 2 points that I just wanted to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ira. Before we open the question for the audience, just a short comments on the variations of the quality of school experiences. That would also be interesting because we've mainly now focusing on the policies. So, yeah. So, Ira and Jeet, mainly you work on this.
So, the variation in terms of school experiences, Indian children experience.
Mm.
So I think I said it when I first spoke that because it is multi-layered, like even the government system, you'll have a very poorly functioning government school and you will have a very aspirational government school. So, and they are both there, so some of us, feel maybe shame in saying that I studied through a government school, but there are others who say I studied from a government school. So there are like Navodaya Vidyalaya or, there are schools, where government invested good money, proper, like they had, enough teachers, enough infrastructure, and that helped these schools do well. And in comparison, some other schools, they are also run by the government, but, not much resources are available. There is only one teacher dealing with 50 kids or sometimes more. And there is hardly any support available. Some of them are in remote areas where, nobody goes for inspection or even, just telling that person that, it's good that you are at least coming to school, walking maybe 10 kilometers a day. So within government system, you have this variation. And one of the reasons is that you wanted to make it accessible or available to everyone. So even if, you didn't have proper building or, not enough teachers, you said, okay, we'll hire some contractual, teachers, and you made provision for some, availability of one person and maybe one room, which is a community room, something like that. Later, when we had Right to Education Act, then, we did have government, clear directions that, we will define what would a school mean. Anything can't be a school. You have to have a certain infrastructure in place and teachers must have some training. Without that, you cannot define that as a school. So that came quite late, like in 2009. And so everything like to do it at national level, is a huge challenge. And we understand it because we run 9 schools. So 9 schools versus like 15 million schools, 1.5 million schools, 1.5 million schools. So we understand it because of our own practice that, it's not easy to run, such a huge system. But it can be done, I think, because there is provision by the government that you have a district level, institute for academic purposes. There is a district level department to look into administrative aspects. So in terms of your system, things are there, but maybe the district institute doesn't have all the faculties who are supposed to be there. So And they come from, maybe they were teachers once and they didn't get enough support or like capacity building to become teacher educators. Mm. So those kind of issues are there. And within private sector, because it is a huge private sector catering to almost 35 to 40% of our students, there, I think the top 10%, 20% may be doing very well in terms of academic development. Rest of them are very questionable quality private schools. The only thing they offer is probably, you know, English exposure. Other than that, or maybe, you know, there is a teacher in every class. But other than that, you know, if you look into other aspects, or you know how good they are doing art education or you know physical education, they may not be doing at all. Mm-hmm. So it's not that only government schools are struggling, like some of them, but private schools, maybe not many people have looked into that. Yeah. And so they are equally, you know, struggling.
Yeah.
So we have, I think, a major task at our hand, how to really improve education. We have 250 260 million students studying, and I think maybe about 200 million out of those 260 need better experiences.
I just want to say one thing. That irrespective, and we all have this experience, all of us go out into the field very often, irrespective of the infrastructure, resources, the challenges, there are some teachers who are doing exceptional work. Mm. And it's really has to be noted that with very little support, they're still getting on very, very well. So I think it all depends on the kind of teachers and school leaders we have to a large extent, like everywhere else.
Yeah, yeah. You want to add, Ira?
No, I think the points have been covered. I think we would leave some time for question and answers.
Yeah. It's very good. I think some watching some YouTube videos, I think the most innovative teachers also are in India. And when I was teaching in Singapore in the National Institute of Education, I remember I was teaching every year also the Teach for India scholars. And there, I mean, the enthusiasm was something that was really kind of has stayed in me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But please, audience, online and here, any questions, anything that you want to ask from our panelists?